Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be speaking about the Islamic State in Africa. And I'm joined by an important guest, Professor Jason Wana. Dr. Wana is the Research Director and Senior Analyst, African Terrorism and Transnational Crimes at the U.S. Army's Foreign Military Studies Office, and is also the author of the book, The Islamic State in Africa, The Emergence, Evolution, and Future of the Next Jihadist Battlefield. Jason, I'm delighted to have you today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Great. So I'll just start. So what is the state of ISIS since the death of Abu Baghdadi in 2019?
Right. Well, first of all, I will say thanks for having me. I've always respected you, Michael, and I'm glad to be part of the show, and I've followed it, and so I'm really pleased to be here. I should also just say that everything that I'm saying today is my own personal opinion. Though I'm contracted to the U.S. government, everything I'm saying is in my own personal capacity. So nothing that I'm going to say today is representative of the official U.S. Government stance. In terms of the status of the Islamic State today, when it comes to the Islamic State globally, it's certainly on a sort of downswing from what it had historically been when we saw its rise in 2014, and really its height between 2014 and 2016, 2017. But though the Islamic State sort of globally is on a decline or you know at a sort of lower tempo than it has historically been, important for our conversation is that the center of gravity of the Islamic State really is now in Africa. And so as we develop this conversation, I think it's useful to sort of juxtapose those two ideas, which is that globally, the Islamic State is nowhere nearly as powerful as it used to be. But to the extent that it does remain relevant and somewhat powerful, it's really an African story.
Brilliant. Now, so in the book, which, you know, I reviewed and it was quite interesting. It's a big eye opener. You and your co-authors argue that Africa is the new frontier of jihadism. You know, we have several jihadist groups, not just ISIS and other kind of stuff. What is the scope of ISIS in Africa? Where is it located? Is there any similarities to ISIS Central? Is there any peculiarities, you know?
Absolutely. Right. So in the book, which my co-authors and I published in 2021, we really introduced the sort of emergence and the evolution of the Islamic State in Africa. So for those who are interested in this topic, I think our book is probably the best sort of introduction and sort of deep dive, probably longer than most people would care to read of this topic. And so really what we were interested in writing the book was answering a few important questions that were sort of puzzling. So one question that the book tried to answer was, how did the Islamic State, which originated in Iraq and Syria, find so many adherents on the African continent? In other words, why did insurgent groups in Africa decide to pledge allegiance or pledge bayah to the Islamic State Central? So that was one of the questions we sought to answer. Another question we sought to answer was how, once these initial sort of pledges of allegiance came, how did the Islamic State brand spread throughout Africa? And the third sort of main question we asked was, how do all of the provinces of the Islamic State in Africa compare and contrast to one another? In this regard, we were sort of looking at how do they compare and contrast in regards to patterns of violence, to number of fighters, to relationships with the Islamic State Central, to the relationships with civil society? And so those are some of the broad questions that we were asking in the book. So the answers to all of these questions, or to your original question, is really contained in the book. But really, the broad scope is that at present, there are 8 Islamic State provinces in Africa. Some are very powerful. Some are essentially defunct. These branches are in Algeria, which is essentially defunct, Libya, the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. The Islamic State Greater Sahara is in the sort of Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso tri-border area. The Islamic State West Africa province is in the Lake Chad basin at the intersection of Nigeria, Niger, Chad and Cameroon. Then you've got the Islamic State Central Africa province, which has 2 branches, one in Mozambique, one in DRC, and the Islamic State in Somalia. So those are the 8 different provinces. Some are very powerful, some not as much. That's sort of the broad lay of the land, and we can dive into more specifics about how they compare and contrast to one another, their relationships with Islamic State Central, etc.
Like Riley mentioned, some are powerful, some are not that powerful. In the book, you kind of like distinguish between some that are like provinces. You say wilaya that are provinces, and some that are affiliates. So can you expand on that? Does that have any impact on, you know, the scale of their influence?
Sure. So for those who were sort of uninitiated or unaware, how do you become an Islamic State province, right? It's not a sort of intuitive process. So essentially what happens is that an insurgent group or a violent extremist organization pledges allegiance or pledges bayat to the Islamic State Central. So to recall, the Islamic State Central is like the core leadership of the Islamic State, what other people call ISIS or ISIL, based in Iraq and Syria. So the way that an African insurgent group becomes a province or wilayat, as you said, of the Islamic State is as follows. They essentially have to issue a formal declaration of allegiance to the Islamic State Central. The Islamic State Central has sort of one of 3 broad options. One, it can just ignore this pledge of allegiance, which is the least desirable outcome for the group. The second is that the Islamic State Central can say, thank you, hear you, but we're not comfortable making you a formal province or wilayah. And the third and best outcome for these African insurgent groups that are pledging is that the Islamic State Central says, yes, we hear your pledge, and we are going to confer upon you the title of an Islamic State province, an official Islamic State province. So the 8 provinces that I mentioned previously are representative of groups that pledged allegiance and that actually got that official designation as a province. But to your question, Michael, there are other groups that have pledged allegiance that had one of the other 2 outcomes, right? That are either the Islamic State Central ignored their request, or in the case of Tunisia, which I think is probably the one you're referring to, the Islamic State Central acknowledged it and said, yeah, we will refer to your fighters as soldiers of the caliphate, but we're not going to confer upon you the title of an official Islamic State province. So I think it's important for listeners to understand the sort of wide range of people that can be affiliated with the Islamic State, some of whom are, you know, members of official Islamic State provinces, ranging to people who have no connection with anything, but who might read and sympathize with Islamic State propaganda online. So there's a very wide range of sort of affiliates of the Islamic State, ranging from very formal to those who are essentially, you know, unaffiliated, but who have sympathy for the group.
So if we look at it at a central level now, like Riley mentioned, there's been a decline. There's been that decline. But surprisingly, parallel to that, we've seen ISIS being strong in Africa. I've read a recent piece, but I wanted to expand on that, where you know, they've said if Africa can present itself as take a lead rather than, you know, the other way around. And I think you've said that is not possible. You don't see that possibility. So I wanted you to expand on that and say.
Right. So you're referring, I believe, to a piece I published a few weeks ago in response to a new report that the United Nations Monitoring Committee on basically the United Nations has a monitoring committee that looks at the state of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State around the world. And so the United Nations essentially leverages intelligence from its constituent member countries and about what they know about these groups and compiles them into a report, which it then puts out to the world and says, this is, according to our members, you know, the state of play of the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda in the world. And it's really useful. And it's something that terrorism scholars, you can hear my daughter.
I understand that.
It's happy over here. They're not being, there's all good things happening apparently. Apologies. But the point of this is that, it's released twice a year, and it's something that terrorism scholars around the world really look at because it represents a sort of, not a consensus, but a sort of global overview of sort of what this landscape looks like. And in the most recent one that was released at the end of January, there was one really notable inclusion. And I've been tracking these, reading these for 5 or 6 years because they're sort of useful. But one of the inclusions that was really striking to me was this note, and it was one of the main takeaways, that essentially said the United Nations intelligence from its member states had suggested that the Islamic State leadership, because of the challenges it was having in Iraq and Syria, looked like it was trying to move somewhere. The United Nations said the two places that it saw that potentially happening were either Afghanistan or Africa, with Africa being the most likely. So essentially, the United Nations is putting out this statement saying, we think that the Islamic State's leadership, which is believed to be based in Iraq, is moving to Africa, most likely moving to Africa. And so the piece that I wrote that you're referencing is really trying to assess this. Is it likely that the Islamic State's leadership would move to Africa? And it was the case that I was in other meetings around the same time where we were discussing this. It was something that was on a lot of people's minds. And so I finally just sat down and put together my thoughts. I'm not sure how persuasive other people found it, but actually having gone through the exercise, I thankfully believe my own sort of argument and rationale. Essentially, I think it's unlikely. I think it's really unlikely. And in the piece, I essentially lay out why I think it's unlikely. I think one of the foundations of the piece is that I think is important is to recognize what we mean by leadership. So the United Nations was a little bit vague in its terminology of what it meant by leadership. So what I really, and I had some wonderful collaborators really push me to think through this. There's a difference between the leader of the Islamic State, the caliph essentially, versus people who have leadership positions. And so being very clear about what we mean about, you know, is the Islamic State's leadership moving to Africa? There are two different answers to that, depending on if you're talking about the leader or top leadership. So one of the things that I bring about in the piece is that if we're talking about top leaders who are important, that's very much already happening. In other words, there are a number of people who are Africans who have top leadership positions. Bilal al-Sudani, who was killed not so long ago, was one of the Islamic State's top financial sort of facilitators. So, you know, he's one example of someone who has a very important leadership position within the Islamic State, he was Sudanese. He was attached to the Al-Qarar office in Somalia. And there are also emirs of these various Islamic State provinces in Africa. So there are all sorts of people who are prominent in leadership positions who are African. So on that front, there already is very much African leadership within the Islamic State. That's different than asking, is the Islamic State caliph or the ultimate sort of singular leader going to move to Africa? On that question, my answer was really no. And there are a number of reasons why I think it's difficult. But at the end of the day, I essentially walk through all these different scenarios that would potentially compel the Islamic State's leader, the top leader, to relocate from what we imagine to be, you know, a life in Iraq to Africa. And there are all of these challenges with it. These include the fact that sort of making the physical move would be difficult, sort of trying to evade, you know,
London,
the international system that's trying to catch you would be difficult. Yeah. There are these challenges with reintegrating into a different state. So for instance, if he was to try to move to, say, Somalia or Mali or Burkina Faso, integration into those societies would be difficult. There's also sort of backlash that he might face from the broader Islamic State sort of constituency around the world that, you know, the ideas that he had given up on the fight in Iraq and Syria. So there are all of these reasons why, and that's just a brief list, but all these reasons why I don't see the Islamic State's leader ultimately relocating from Iraq, presumably Iraq, to somewhere on the continent.
Mm-hmm. But I want to add another dimension to that and see if you agree with that. So if I look at the Islamic State in West Africa, and look at some of the arguments in the debate about whether African Islamic State in Africa or insurgents in Africa or militants in Africa is driven by local grievances or global grievances. If I look at that debate, and then again, if I look at Islamic State in West Africa, ISWAP, and how the division between ISWAP and, you know, and JAS, the rivalry between them was about the way I see it, the late Shekau, you know, wanted to, or is driven largely by local stuff and couldn't reflect or be a proxy for, there's always that tension. So if I look at it in that aspect, is that what makes it's challenging for Africa to present, you know, that leadership? And then again, you mentioned Dick Khalif, the determiner D. So I see as D, because another thing is also some of these Emirs or leaders, and they're also appropriating themselves as the Khalif. Shekau was going to say the Khalif as well. So is there a tension between, do we respect the Khalif in Iraq, or am I also the Khalif here? You know, do we saw those kind of like tensions?
Yeah, right. So one of the challenges that I sort of bring about in the piece is that, to, you know, one of the sort of theoretical rationales that would allow the Islamic State's, the number one Islamic State leader to be based in Africa would be if, for instance, the Islamic State named an African caliph, right? Mm-hmm. So that rather than having, you know, an Iraqi caliph, if they were to name an African as a caliph, but because the caliph would need to be Qureshi, or in essence, from the lineage of the Arabian Peninsula, that's not going to happen. I mean, you could probably find someone who maybe fits that bill. It'd be quite difficult. But the fact that the caliph of the Islamic State will very unlikely ever be an African is, I think, speaks to some of the tension that you're talking about, which is that there is, you know, in the same way that you're sort of talking about how ISWAP's challenges and sort of global outlook have been hyper-local, in the same way, the Islamic State's very origins are in their own way sort of parochially Iraqi and Syrian. And so I think that there is this tension about the reconciliation between local and global affinities, and you probably know this better than anyone, but within the broader sort of study of terrorism and transnational jihadism sort of studies in Africa, this is one of the most contentious debates, right? Is this local versus global sort of framing? And we can get into that, but that is sort of the dividing line in the sort of ways that people have historically divided themselves in terms of how they think about what these groups mean and how they fit into the sort of global hierarchy of violence, I would say.
Does that also play into how, I don't know if it plays into how the Islamic State in Africa has been successful, relatively successful compared to you know, to the ones in the Middle East?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, one of the things that the Islamic State, I think, has been, that has made the Islamic State brand very resonant in Africa, among other things, is the sort of flexibility that it's offered. In other words, whereas Al-Qaeda, particularly under bin Laden and, you know, during bin Laden's years, there was a sort of much more focused attempt to kind of control and monitor and oversee and be involved in the affairs of what the Al-Qaeda branches were doing. And I think for the Islamic State, there has been a sense of a laissez-faire attitude in many respects, not all respects to be sure, but in many respects, which is, hey, you know, particularly in regards to violence, right? So that that provinces and their people are sort of more at ease to kind of or more at liberty to take their own approaches to violence, to governance. Now, there has been a sort of rolling back and an attempt to kind of reel this in and not be sort of, you know, unabashedly violent towards anyone and anything. But that's sort of been one of the reasons that I think, to your point, the Islamic State brand has resonated, because it, you know, among others, it was globally powerful, right? It showed this massive territorial gain in Iraq and Syria. The propaganda machine was incredibly powerful and potent, particularly as compared to Al-Qaeda's. And then once, you know, these groups got the global branding and the global marker, they weren't really constrained, I guess I would say, in what it meant to be an Islamic State affiliate. In other words, as opposed to sort of the way that Al-Qaeda branches were attempted to be governed, and that weren't always by any stretch, the Islamic State has historically had a more kind of hands-off, do your own thing kind of approach to them. And so I think that that does play into the resonance of the brand on the continent.
There's also that argument that some of these groups were pledging or trying to affiliate based on that the only utility that they were deriving from was just the branding. That the ISM Central House, you know, it was more symbolic, if I use the word, was more symbolic in rather than material. Material assistance. How much material assistance, or is, you know, largely, was he more symbolic, or were there also material assistance that were accompanying these pledges, and what was this scale of that?
Yeah, great question. So you see the relationship between the African provinces and Islamic State Central, particularly in regards to material benefits, kind of ebb and flow over time. So for the first three Islamic State provinces in Africa, those in Algeria, Libya, and Sinai, which emerged in late 2014, that's when the Islamic State Central really did have a lot of money. And in those countries, we saw evidence, and everything we've done is open source, so there may be other stories that are going on behind the scenes that we don't know about. But during that period, the Islamic State Central, there was a fair amount of open source evidence showing that the Islamic State Central was sending certainly emissaries, sort of bureaucrats and diplomats from the Islamic State Central to go to these places. It was sending some amounts of money. It was sending some amounts of arms, particularly in Sinai. We saw evidence of that. In the case of ISWAP, we also saw some significant transfers of money. Again, this would have been, you know, they pledged in March 2015. So this sort of, you know, 2015-ish period when the Islamic State Center was doing really well in Iraq and Syria. As it declined, particularly 2018, 2019, 2020, this is when you start to see the sort of small amounts of funding and assistance to these groups sort of trickle off and sort of decline. At the current moment, you know, some of my colleagues, Ryan O'Farrell, who is a co-author of mine on the book, and his other colleague, Caleb Weiss, have done some fascinating work on the Islamic State Central and the ADF, or the DRC province, and its role in sort of funding. And essentially what's happening now is that the benefit for these provinces is not necessarily their receipt of material goods from the Islamic State Central, but their ability to support one another. So rather than getting benefits in a sort of hierarchical way where the Islamic State Central is giving them material benefits, it's how all of the provinces are sort of supporting each other and being used in a lateral sense to help provide and move money, people, and weapons in some cases.
We've seen similar stuff. Some people, there's an edited volume that I'm editing that I've just submitted on Boko Haram, rethinking Boko Haram. And one piece, I don't know if you know James Barnett.
Of course, yeah.
James has contributed with his quote on looking at the connections between ISWAP, Boko Haram, and all the Canada Insurgent Group in the Sahel and all of that. And then you've rightly just mentioned how it's also about, I want to know how, because again, we've also seen competition between these groups.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then they've also been able to come together and cooperate where they have to cooperate. I wanted to know what motivation is driving these corporations and competition, this push and pull. What are the things really driving this push and pull between these groups?
So the competition that we see is primarily between Al Qaeda and Islamic State affiliated groups. So we don't.
Sorry, Jason, to cut. That's what I was going to. Add to that. I wanted to talk exactly in relation to Al Qaeda and ISIS. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. Very good. Right. So just to be clear, very little competition between IS provinces. But to your point, Michael. Competition and outright violence between Islamic State provinces and Al Qaeda branches that coexist in the same areas. So, you know, the main ones that we see are really in the Sahel, where you have the Islamic State Greater Sahara, the Islamic State Sahel province, in the same area of operation as JNIM, which is the Al Qaeda sort of a branch there, and separately in Somalia, where you have Al-Shabaab, which is Al-Qaeda's East Africa branch, and the Islamic State in Somalia. So those are the two sort of centers in Africa where you do see violence. I mean, violence between Al-Qaeda and Islamic State groups. why does it happen? Different periods of time have different causes or different explanations. So in the case of Al-Shabaab fighting the Islamic State in Somalia, one of the primary sources of tension there was sort of early in the Islamic State in Somalia's emergence. I believe this was 2018 when the Islamic State Central was trying to convince Al-Shabaab, a very powerful, arguably the most powerful or one of the most powerful VEOs in Africa, to leave Al-Qaeda and to become the Islamic State Somali province. So essentially the Islamic State Central in Iraq and Syria reached out to Al-Shabaab and said, hey, we know you guys have been, you know, an Al-Qaeda branch for several years now. How about leave Al-Qaeda and become our Islamic State branch in Somalia? That did not sit well with Al-Shabaab leadership, which really rejected this. But some of the guys within Al-Shabaab did leave, and they were the ones to start the Islamic State in Somalia branch. So one source of tension was really that, you know, in this case, Al-Shabaab, which is Al-Qaeda's East Africa branch, was really mad that, A, the Islamic State had dared ask it to leave Al-Qaeda, and secondly, that some of its guys actually did leave. Al-Shabaab, there are numerous instances of Al-Shabaab attacking Islamic State and Somalia adherents. In the Sahel, tensions have sort of ebbed and flowed. For a while, Henny Nsaibia, who is one of the co-authors on the book, and again, Caleb Weiss, who's a phenomenal analyst, they wrote about the Sahel as being, what people were calling at that time, the Sahelian anomaly. And by that, they meant that around the world, this sort of competition between Al Qaeda and the Islamic State that you mentioned, Michael, has been normal, right? Any places where we've seen Al Qaeda and the Islamic State existing in the same areas, violence has normally followed. The Sahel was unique for a while. For a while, the Islamic State and Al Qaeda collaborated, not necessarily hand in hand, but they had similar targets, right? They were similarly targeting the Malian government, French forces, MINUSMA, et cetera. But that didn't last long, right? That Sahelian anomaly of cooperation between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State didn't last long. There had been years of violence that sort of ensued between the groups. Contemporarily, I think that they are, my understanding, and I don't track this quite as closely as I used to, but is that they have kind of called the detente and are sort of agreeing to stop fighting with one another so as to target mutual enemies.
Mm. Oh, brilliant. So when we look at all of this and look at, so again, if I look at what's going on in, if I pick Israel, for instance, and then I look at the death of Shekau, and I look at the death of some of the leaders in ISIS leaders have been killed since 2009, since Abu Bakr. How much impact does decimation of these leaders do to this group?
Yeah. I think we're at the point now where we realize that, you know, though there are exceptions, the killing of leaders is not the way to you know, fundamentally degrade these groups. You know, we've seen the Islamic State Central has had multiple leaders killed, you know, over and over. They emerge and they don't even really emerge anymore. They're killed before they actually are sort of prominently known. That's one of the reasons, by the way, that the United Nations was assessing that they might be trying to leave Iraq and move to Africa, precisely because of these successive killings of top Islamic State leaders. But what we don't see is the leadership of, you know, the killing or even change of power of leadership in these groups radically changing what they do and how they act. Particularly, there was one of the points we've kind of made over the years as we've discussed some of these phenomena is what really doesn't matter to change the landscape in Africa of the Islamic State is the killing of an Islamic State caliph. Right. In other words, if the leader of the Islamic State Central is killed, we've seen very, very little evidence and others may have information. I don't, but that doesn't move the needle at all on the continent, precisely because the African affiliates of the Islamic State really are pretty autonomous. They really do sort of operate on their own accord. To your point, it's perhaps better than nothing, but certainly not the sort of be all and end all to really radically change things.
Yeah. Well, in some of the places as well, we've seen, so in Mozambique, for instance, there's the idea that the ISIS there has been degraded.
Right.
How true is this? And, you know, how,
well,
it, does that, right. does that also present? Okay, go on.
Well, no, I mean, I think in Mozambique, it's really more a story about the Rwandan success there. You know, it's part and parcel, I suppose. But you know, Mozambique has been a unique case given the heavy involvement of Rwanda and the SADC contingent. And so, I would say overall, as someone who has kind of looked at the broader arc of history of the Islamic State in Africa, and others may disagree with me, I don't think of an instance in which the killing of a leader of any of these branches has radically changed the trajectory of any of the provinces. People may disagree with me, but like having sort of looked at this for years, there's no part of me that sort of says, well, here's a great example of how it's really changed things. You know, some of the phenomena that I think are really useful to degrading groups are you know, the taking away of territory. I mean, so one of the great successes that we've seen that I think doesn't really get discussed enough is, you know, if you recall between 2014 and 2016, the Islamic State in Libya occupied tracts of land, entire cities or portions of entire major Libyan cities. And I don't think we really give it enough credence about, you know, how that control was really wiped out by a series of successive, you know, multinational campaigns. Similarly, you know, the Islamic State in Somalia held, you know, the town or city of Kandala for a while. Mozambique, there are obviously sort of territorial holdings. These are the things that I think shift the momentum of some of these groups more. In other words, the reclaiming of territory much more so than the killing of specific leaders.
So indeed, it is holding up territories. What we see, so for, I think for ISIS Central and in some of these other places, we see an attempt at governance, well, in other places as well, we didn't see that. But what we're seeing right now, we're seeing some sort of attempt to win hearts and minds. So if you look at ISIS in Mali, for instance, in Nigeria, for instance, in the fringes of the Lake Chad, one of the authors in the edition is looking at the political economy of ISIS. ISIS is trying to governance, trying to like govern how trade is being done in there, fishing, farming. So if you look at how they're seeking legitimacy, what would you say? Are they looking to rebrand? Are they looking to have less, present themselves as an alternative form of governance compared to like the killings and the violence? How do you interpret that?
No, that's great. And I would love to hear more from you about the ISWAP sort of governance structures. But I think ISWAP is one that that comes to top of mind now for me in terms of an Islamic State branch that is really trying to to use your wording, to win hearts and minds. The sort of efforts that ISWAP in the Lake Chad region is using, so you mentioned sort of regulating fishing. I read about their attempts to regulate prices for basic commodities, encouraging people to come back to the area, sort of overseeing, sort of cattle rustling or sort of providing these real services that people want. Though, also leveraging or levying taxes, punishing people who don't, it is a modicum of governance beyond merely, if I don't agree with you, I'll shoot you, right? There is a much more nuanced sort of approach. And ISWAP is in many ways distinct from its analog, JAS, precisely because JAS did want to continue this sort of unfettered violence, right? They liked the Shekau kind of anyone is a target if I deem them to be. And so I think ISWAP is a really good sort of contrast to that, which is it still sort of brutal? Yeah, but is there a little bit more thought and a little bit more kind of morality, for lack of a better word, behind it? Yeah. I don't know if you agree with that, Michael. You focus more on
that. I think, to be honest, I think it's ISWAP originally would have wanted to repair the image, the damaged image that Shekau style of leadership. But it's always been a mixed bag. So, to some degree, they provide our governance. They provide, in many of those places, there's obviously a palpable lack of governance there. So they fill in that vacuum to provide. But at the same time, like Riley said, they put in tax as well. They're cutting, people that don't, they also use some violent measures. So it's like a give and take kind of stuff that we're seeing there. But it is not to the scale, the kind of violence they do is not to the scale where we see with JAS or what we see with JAS. It's a lot.
Right.
It's a lot different. It's a lot more nuanced.
And it's almost, and I don't know if you would agree with me. I mean, the way I think about what they're doing is it's almost somewhat acting like a state, right? Where you think of the state as the legitimate sort of purveyor of violence. Like that's sort of what ISWAP is kind of doing. It's an alternative state structure where, yes, it employs violence in the same way that states employ military force or police force, but it is, it is enacting some amounts of law and order, as it were, not respecting human rights by any stretch of the imagination, but in a way that is more reasonable than what you have seen from other sort of VEOs, I would argue.
Yeah, but that again brings me to the question I was going to ask before I come to the last question. So my writings over the years have always been, and this is where in the volume that I'm editing, I'm looking at Bokaram Post 2015. I'm looking at it's lost. My argument is lost that religious ideological credential that he was fighting for initially, and it's more about power. So if you look at what he says, it's more about trying to establish this kind of like state level kind of stuff. So I want to say more broadly, looking at ISIS in other provinces, do you think it's driven more by ideology, or is there anything other than ideology that is driving? The driving force behind.
Yeah, I'm not a scholar of religion primarily, and so I don't look at things primarily through a religious lens. I have always found it to be, and I would really be, I think I echo your sentiment here. The way I've always looked at these groups is the following. Are there some people who deeply believe in the ideology? Yes, certainly. Mm. Is that what is primarily motivating people to violence? Is that primarily what's mobilizing people? Is that primarily why people are involved in these groups? I don't personally think so. The way that I view this is a powerful brand that is an incredibly useful, mobilizing ideology that gives individual leaders and groups of people the ability to accrue power to live better lives, to get more of what they want. And so I think in that sense, I view this, I think, in the same way that you do, which is this is much more about the accrual of power and the ability to figure out how to get more of what you want out of life than is a sort of existential, cosmological world belief view. For some, it's certainly that, but I think for others, it is much more materially sort of centric. I don't know how you
You just captured. I thought you read my. Maybe you read my.
I got an early copy. It's great. There's a few typos on page 19, but no. Yeah, that's how I think about it. And it's interesting to hear.
I agree with you 100%. I agree with you. You capture exactly my essence of the group. Yeah. But in terms of responses and how effective they are, we've seen. And in the light of how how do you see the responses internationally, regionally, and the domestic level?
I mean, not great. It's been really disheartening to see how poorly the international community has fared. I mean, from African states to global powers to multinational efforts, like it's the more we've tried, the worse things have gotten. And I think we can't hide behind that. Trisha Bacon, a brilliant scholar at American University, and I wrote, we were asked to do a paper a few years ago on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. We were asked to do a paper about the state of terrorism in Africa 20 years after 9/11. So sort of saying, how has the war on terror gone from the US perspective 20 years after 9/11? And at that point, this would have been 2021. We were writing this. We knew that, things weren't great in Africa. But when we really dug into the statistics, we were just flabbergasted by how much worse things have gotten in terms of number of deaths caused by jihadist-linked actors, amount of territory controlled by jihadist-linked actors, number of formal groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, sanctioned individuals. The Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have really led Africa to become the global epicenter of jihadist terrorism. And in no small part, that's been due to the presence of external actors, the United States, France, chief among them, the United Nations missions don't help. Certainly, poor African governance is not necessarily helping. Really a concerning phenomenon right now is the bloc between Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, particularly backed by Russian support, in a number of ways. And so right now, the extremely concerning phenomenon that really keeps me up at night is things are getting bad on the continent in terms of this type of violence. And they're only getting worse. They're bad and they're getting worse. And whatever we've collectively been doing is not doing the trick. And in many cases, I think it's been exacerbating the problem. So far from finding a solution, very sadly. Yeah.
Okay. If you take a broad sweep in the last question and say, yes. where do you see, or how do you see this phenomenon? In the trajectory of this phenomenon, in the light of what is going, the responses now, the state now, how, if we were to design an effective response, what would that look like?
I wish I could tell you. I really wish I could. I think the thing that I feel like is kind of ground shattering or has the potential to really alter the status quo of of what's already not a great situation is really Russia's involvement, the increasing involvement of Russia in the most conflict prone spaces on the continent. So the profound backing of Mali, Burkina Faso, increasingly Niger, Guinea, I mean, not to mention, you know, Sudan, Libya, we can go on and on, but the influence of Russia, the increased influence of Russia, particularly in conflict affected societies. It's not just sort of, you know, business as usual, but it is really getting down and dirty into some of the most unstable countries, and creating new coalitions, particularly in the form of this alliance of Sahelian states in the Sahel, that is breaking away potentially, I'm not sure the exact day-to-day of right now, away from ECOWAS, right? Like 5 years ago, if you would have told someone, hey, guess what? Russia's going to create this new alliance of Sahelian states and they're going to leave ECOWAS, people would have been like, you're crazy. I don't think anyone saw that one coming. So that is something between the connection of Russian influence, reduced French influence, and those locations being the center of a lot of this violence. It doesn't portend a happy story in my mind.
Well, I wish you had given us just ended on a little positive.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, sadly, that is the situation. That's the reality, right? And well, Jason, it's been a great honor to finally meet you. And we're I'm very grateful to have you here to provide this very useful insight on the state of the Islamic State in Africa. Thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to seeing you again.
Absolutely. And I can't wait to read your book.
Yeah, sure. I'll definitely be one of the first.
Awesome. All right. Thanks a lot, Michael.
All right. You have a great day. Thank you once again for tuning in to today's episode. And join me to thank Professor Jason Wana for his useful and powerful insight into the state of the Islamic State in Africa. Stay tuned to the next episode, and don't forget to subscribe to our channels for more updates. Thank you, and see you next week.